addict.
Amen.
And I first just want to thank God for another day clean and for leading me into such a wonderful program. And welcome to all the newcomers. Keep coming because this program does work. Just grateful to be here. And I, you know, I could say a lot of things, I suppose, and I'll try to keep it simple. I met Karen probably 5 or 6 years ago. She came to our area and spoke. And we connected, and I stayed in touch with her. You know, sometimes we meet people, and we say, if you want what we have to offer, you have to do what we do. And sometimes, for me, I've had to take a chance, and I've had to reach out to people because they had what I wanted. And Karen was one of those people. And we kept in touch, and I ended up going to her house a few years back, and we email. I kind of follow her around. If she's speaking somewhere close to Michigan, we'll drive to just come and see her and support her. And that's the beauty of this program, is developing friendships. And I love Karen to death. I hope that you guys could hear what I was saying. She, if you haven't heard her speak before, you're really in for a treat. She still does service. She works with newcomers. And I just consider her my friend, one of my mentors, and my NA sister. And I'm going to bring up Karen B. Hi.
Hi.
I'm Karen. I'm an addict.
Hi.
I'm in Omaha. I'm from Santa Cruz, California. I came here just to be with you, yes. Eat tofu, drink bottled water, read the basic text. Woo! No, you're missing the point.
I was like talking about California.
Alrighty. Totally nervous. Okay. So, first of all, I want to thank the programming committee for this terrible mistake. It's been really wonderful being able to fly out here, and this hotel is really nice, and my bed's really nice, and this banquet food was really good. It actually had adult portions, which is very rare at any convention, and you guys are really nice, so I'm really glad to be here. And I want to thank Tammy for being an internet stalker and for bugging me till I came here. And Mark and Joe and, gosh, thanks for having me out here. My father was born in Omaha, Nebraska. If you're listening to the CD, that gap of silence was they were looking at me like an aquarium. I mean, generally in other places when you say, like, your family's from there, they get happy, but I guess they don't appreciate the fact that somebody related to me is from here. All right, sorry. My friend Vicky from Detroit drove me down to see the area where you keep the Jews, and that's where my dad was born. They even had a sandwich shop there, said ethnic sandwiches, which I guess is a warning, I don't know. But I've always wondered what it was like, you know, where he was from. My father was not very proud of himself and didn't really talk much about his ethnicity. And anyway, it did my heart good to look at this place that he's from and know that he was from somewhere pretty cool. And then he moved to Sioux City, Iowa. I guess Iowa's in the house here somewhere? All right. All right. I apologize for anything my family did. So it's great to be here. It's always scary for me to announce anywhere that I'm a Jew because some people don't mind, some people are Jewish, and some people spend a lot of time in places being pretty upset about it. But the reason why I like to speak up about who I am in case there's any mistake is because my differences are what make me important in Narcotics Anonymous. We talk about look for the similarities, but some of us come here looking for the differences to try and alienate ourselves from this place. If you're sitting in this room tonight and you feel hopelessly different from everyone else and you think this isn't going to work for you, your difference is the reason why you're in this room, and it's to open up another chair for somebody different. So I'm grateful for the diversity in Narcotics Anonymous. Yeah.
Another thing that I want to say is if there's anybody in the overflow room who's a newcomer, I'm looking at about 8 empty seats, and I'm not going to start talking until you fill them. So come in. If you are in the overflow room, please come in right now. This, your seat is right here up front. Come on. Right here, overflow room. We're not going to start until you sit here. So we're right here. This is your chair. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Right up here. Right over here. We're so glad to have you. You're so welcome. Thanks for being here tonight. I know it's scary. I know I'm scary. If you're in the back of this room, please move up if you're new. Not because what I have to say is so important, but you're so important. Okay, right up here. And if there's anybody left in the overflow room who feels left out, there's some more seats up here, and there's really no reason for anybody to feel excluded. That's not how this program started. I thought it was really funny. My clean date is August 25th, 1976. I was 3. Shut up. Anyway. And there was a time where things were a lot simpler. They were also kind of like a cartoon of diversity back then. They often accredit a man named Jimmy Kay. He's passed away now, so we call him Jimmy Kennan. He's acknowledged with being the founder of this program, but there were a lot of people that kept it going. Certainly Jimmy did the most work. And the people who were the hardcore, real predecessors when I got clean was Jimmy Kennan, who was Scottish, and a man named Bob B., who's still with us, who was black, and sorry, this always happens. A little Mexican guy named Pepe Acuna. And another person who kept the doors open was a woman who wasn't an addict, and she was the wife of Bob B., and her name was Alma, and she passed away a couple years ago. But she wanted to make sure that there was meetings for women, and so she came and sat in a lot of women's meetings to make sure we wouldn't be alone. She also brought Bob to the program. So when I got clean, they used to say, women don't recover. That was the slogan back then. And it was kind of almost true. There was a very particular type of person who stayed clean. And it was a man who had done needles and who'd been to prison. And that was at the basic sort of overall premise of what you had to be to get clean. I don't know if it was the same way out here. And if you didn't fit into that profile, you were here for, well, women, we were here for the men. Didn't really fit me. I'm straight, but it wasn't about, wow, where can I find a man who's never worked and has no teeth? And sometimes no teeth can be an advantage, I realize that. I'm sorry. You never get better. You recover, but you don't get well. What can I say? But anyway, not like I'd know, because I only vaguely remember sex at this point. But I seem to, anyway. Yeah. Right. So, oh yeah, y'all talk a good game. You're all scared of me. They're like, hey, baby, how much time do you have? Like, 32 years. I guess you have to go like,
a year and one day.
I know, I apologize. You're not here to laugh. Get serious. I'll get real serious. Okay, so Yeah, my story is real serious, but it, after all this time, it bores me to tears. It's pretty intense, but I'll tell you about myself because maybe it'll help you. At this point, what I think are really important are the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts, but I will tell my story. And I'm saying the concepts because if you have any length of time recovery, it's really important for you. I'm sorry that they're not up on the wall, actually. It's really important for you to take a look at the concepts and work them in your life. Anyway, so I'm done with that thing. But anyway, I think it's important. So I got here when I was 21 years old, actually. And I guess there's people who can say, wow, 21, she probably ain't done nothing. You know, okay. If you're listening to the CD, you have no idea what I just said or did. What I did was I just opened my shirt and showed everybody my chest, and that was the subtle laughter that you heard. And it says I have 7 nipples. And so anyway, I'm sorry. I'll get real serious. So anyway, no, it's true. No, it's not. So anyway, so I got here when I was 21 years old, and I'll tell you the truth a little bit about my childhood, and I probably should warn you because it's going to segue into some serious stuff. I always salute at a parade. By the way, turn on your cell phone so we know who's important. Oh, yeah, and text. I've been clean so long, there wasn't even pagers when I got clean. It was totally funny is when pagers came out, we're addicts, everybody had to get a pager, right? I remember going to the 5th World Convention, and pagers had just come out. We all had our pagers. Because we were so important, you know, yeah, I got my pager. Like, thing would go off, and you had to find a payphone back then. It was absolute madness. Okay, so anyway, so here's the deal with me and using. This is kind of a screeching halt segue. I got clean. What happened was I was born into abuse. Now, when I got clean, you didn't talk about it. If you had talked about your childhood, they would have said you're blaming and you must take full responsibility for your actions, what happened to you in the past. It's none of your business. They did the best of what they had, and I'm like going, excuse me, what they had was power tools, you know, because they said they did the best with the tools that they had. Well, it was a drill, all right? And so you walked around in the program holding this stuff inside, these secrets that you didn't tell people because they would judge you as being someone who was self-pitying, and that was considered lethal. And self-pity is lethal, you know, it's just a hair step away from resentment. But there's a difference between self-pity and truth, recognizing what was, because there's no shortcut to forgiveness. And my experience is that you can't stay clean if you don't forgive. Now, if you're sitting here and you're thinking, well, there's certain things that will never be okay, I'll just have to try to be okay with them. You know, your rapes, your molests, severe physical abuse, and you say, well, that relationship will never be repaired, but I will just have to come to terms with those things. My experience in Narcotics Anonymous was that these things can be repaired and forgiven, and the most incongruous relationships can be healed, and not by myself, but by being willing to recover from it. Now, I didn't want to forgive my abuser at all, believe me. I thought it was the only justice that was left for this person since this person never got caught. I thought, well, if I hate him enough, that equals it out, you know. And what I come to find out is that my hatred was punishing me and keeping me feeling very separate in NA. But you know what? I'll get there. But when I was a small child, one of my earliest memories was in the dark being tied. And I was given drugs, which would predict an affinity for downers. But they wanted to keep me quiet because I was a nuisance, you know. There's all kinds of forms of abandonment. You can leave somebody or you can just try to make them insignificant that way and, you know, quiet and not a bother. But look at me. I was this as a kid, okay? Loud, crazy, wah! You know, this didn't just sort of sprout last week. And so here I am, this very loud, active, kind of goofy, smart kid, and I am really interfering with people who are trying to pay attention to themselves, not me. And I got punished a whole lot, And my mother is a survivor of the death camp Auschwitz in Poland. And she had a tattoo on her arm, and she also was able, through her skill, she's an artist, of saving her mother's life. But that's it. I don't have family other than that. When they do the family tree project in school, like, I couldn't participate. And I'm not kidding. I mean, I didn't know. I've never been to a family reunion. This, for me, visiting my dad's house in Omaha, you don't even get how big that is. Because my father was chased by Bolsheviks out of Russia, you know, with his family. They were chased over here. Four of his brothers and sisters died, and he got born when he got here to Omaha. I don't know my family. I have no idea. You know, I would like to say that politically correct NA thing about you are my family. But what I have to say is I don't know how to feel that way about you because I don't know what family feels like. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like when I got to this program, I was an atheist, and people were saying, oh, my God, you are so lucky that you don't have to get rid of religious garbage. Well, the problem with that is when I got here, I didn't know what it felt like to believe in anything. So I didn't know how to believe in anything. And I didn't think it was safe to believe in anything. Because if what there was out there was taking loving care of me, I was screwed, you know? So I was born to a mother who had been through this trauma, and it was untreated, and I was born to a father who was a literal mental patient. He was in the VA and in other mental hospitals. He received over 150 shock treatments in his lifetime, and part of what they thought was good therapy for this man was to bring me to him in these institutions to try to jog his memory as to who I was. So keep in mind that I'm at home getting beaten and abused and locked into dark closets and told there were spiders in there and being hit with objects, some of them very humiliating, like filthy fly swatters in the face. And one time, you know, when I would cry, I would be told I had no right to cry, that only old ladies walking to the gas chamber had a right to cry. And I had my head held under the water in the bathtub to see what it would feel like if somebody was actually trying to kill me, because I used to be afraid I was beaten that I would die. And what I started thinking back then while these things were happening to me was that the problem is not what people are doing to you. The problem is that you feel. I hated that I felt. So I got really sick when I was young, and they started giving me some more drugs for the sickness, and I was so happy. And not only was I happy, but people treated me kindly because I was ill. And I discovered, the way to enjoy life is to be really under the influence and really quiet and really sick, and then everybody loves you. And I carried that with me. And they kept skipping me grades in school because I taught myself how to read and some other things. I'm pretty smart. I'm just pretty crazy, you know. And so not only was I the Jew in school and the cootie girl, but I was several years younger than everybody else, and I was loud. It's funny, because of Facebook, I got in touch with the other cootie boy in class, also happened to be Jewish, and we compare notes that we used to spend the entire school year with our desks facing the corner. We always were stuck in the corner and spent the whole year there. So... Yeah. So when I think of some of the things that I went through and thinking about how I told myself I just have to stop feeling, by the time I used to crawl into the neighbor's house through the dog door to steal cigarettes, I stopped losing any kind of concern for boundaries or trouble that I could get into. Nothing really mattered as much as not feeling my feelings. I remember... finding alcohol in the bottom of some glasses when my mom had a party and drinking it all and just about passing out, and they thought it was very cute, but what it is almost lethal, you know. Kids can die of alcohol poisoning. And I'm not saying that my home was like this place of big drunks. My dad was kicked out pretty early, and it was just my mom there. I'm saying that I discovered substance on my own at a young age, and I can honestly say that I began to use with the intent to get high regularly when I was 12. And I don't think that's that unusual anymore, but back then it was kind of unusual. And I would take samplings from the medicine cabinet and buy things for my older sister. And just, you know, the thing is that I didn't spend a lot of money on drugs because people liked to see me high. They enjoyed it. Apparently I'm very entertaining. And I would coincidentally make friends with people who had access to things like alcohol and other substances, and I was given things rather freely. And I actually had some shit tried out on me when I was 14 years old to see what it was. And it turned out to be a substance that was really cut very poorly, and I ended up taking my nails and digging chunks of skin out of the back of my hands, you know, just ripping up handfuls of myself in my own hands. And I had some really degrading experiences. I remember walking through an art museum and just urinating on myself because the exhibit was scaring me. And then just, you know, a kid, a teenager standing there covered in my own urine. And I remember going to school and people constantly showing me test scores and trying to tell me I was smart and what was wrong with me. And then I was sitting under the desk in history class, like on acid, looking at the gum on the bottom of the desk. And just, I never made that connection. People would try to help me and I would just get furious because I always thought anybody trying to help me was scolding me for not being better. And I could not connect. I lost the ability to connect because I felt so betrayed with the lot that I'd been dealt. And I started learning to become violent and rude myself. It was like I was on this campaign. If I can be without feeling and really violent and really rude, I will survive. I got an I Hate People bumper sticker when I was, I think, 18, 19, and put it on my car, and I just felt like, there. Whew. There I am. I've landed. That's right. That's who I am. And I'm sitting at the corner of Sunset and Gardner. And this car pulls up to me, and this guy rolls down his window, and he hangs out, and he goes, "Hey, sweetheart, you don't really mean it. You don't really hate people, do you?" You know? And I'm just like, "Fuck you! And I just remember him like, driving off, and totally, and this was like before road rage or shooting, you know, this is like predecessor. And I just, you know, as shitty as I could be to people in gas stations and at stores, and like, "What do you want? This is what I want. Give it to me now. Okay, thanks. Shut up." You know, it's pretty much the way I operated, like Tourette's with no syndrome. Just, I got married. It lasted like 90 days. I got disowned from my family because I married somebody outside of the race. And I lived in this room, and he left, and there I was in this room. And what happened to me was I couldn't be awake and not be loaded. I ended up there when I was 21. I remember somebody giving me a pamphlet with all those questions on it. Do you use at work? Do you use in the morning? Do you? And I'm looking at the shit going, "What? What does this have to do with anything whatsoever? You use when your eyes open so that you won't feel anything. And when your eyes are closed, you don't feel, so you're right. I don't understand these daytime slots." I remember the only question I answered no to was, "Do you use when you work?" And that's because I never worked.
I'm honest.
So anyway, I'm living in this apartment. Everybody's gone. I have no friends. My hobby, what I did was I took cats, stray cats, and threw them in the pool to watch them swim. The last week I used, I found two boxes of chocolate pudding in the cupboard, and I made it and put my bare feet in it while I was high so I could be high and have feet in chocolate pudding. I have no explanation for what I'm telling you. I'm just running down the last week to you, okay? And I also stopped washing my body because I thought that I was going to get murdered if I took a shower because I'd seen Psycho, and I thought that Alan Bates was going to if I took a shower. So I was in my grandmother's muumuu. It was 104 degrees in L.A., August. I'm not washing myself. I'm loaded 24/7, putting my feet in pudding and throwing cats in a pool. I am not lying. And the truth of the matter is I smelled so bad and I was so insane that if Alan Bates were to happen upon me anywhere, he would take one whiff and he'd be all, "Oh, hell," and, you know, run away from me and I'd be fine. Norman Bates, thank you. Some kind of Bates. Master. I don't know. So, well, here's a good CD for World. But anyway, I don't care. I could give a rat. So anyway, this guy comes over to my house, and he's one of my neighbors, and he says, "I think you have a problem, and we want to help you." Now, there were two people left on the planet talking to me. It was two guys, and they were together all the time. So I decided they were in love with me. they take me out to this nightclub, a lovely, elegant spot called Filthy McNasty's. And I'm there in my moo-moo, right? And they're sitting me down because they want to have this conversation with me. And they're like, look, we think you have a problem. And we think you need a 12-step program. And I'm like, fuck you, if I ever decide not to get high, I'm not doing it in steps. I'm doing it all at once. Because I knew everything. So I go in the bathroom, and there's these two girls crying over a toilet. And I, being incredibly intelligent and having been court-ordered to therapy a few times in my life, I knew a lot about life. And I said to them, what seems to be the problem? And they said, we're in a 12-step program, and we just blew it. And the coincidence of the conversation I just had and what they said stopped me dead in my tracks, and I had the proverbial moment of clarity. And I actually saw a flash of light, and a moment of calm washed over me like I hadn't felt since I was a tiny little kid, and I walked back out to the table, and I said to these guys, I'm going to do this 12-step thing. And they were like, thank God. And the waitress comes over and she gives me this big glass of wine to celebrate, and I drank it. Because it was free. And as much as I like to say I never turned a trick for money, I have always been a hoe. It just wasn't for money. I wasn't smart enough to ask. I have done it for a coat before. And had to pay that back in recovery. I had to go to the person's house, and while he and his wife stood there laughing at me, give them the $9. Yeah. Self-esteem. So the next day I got on the phone, I called a hotline, and I called the other program. Because I didn't know about this program. And so I called the other program, and this really nice, very square lady answered the phone, and she's like, oh, honey, are you new? Can I help you? And I'm like, fuck you! I have Tourette's at her, and she gives me an address and hangs up on me. So the next day I go to this address, and there's this guy sitting at the head of the table, and he has a worn white t-shirt on with little holes in it, and he has worn Levi's, and he had a crew cut, and he had really smudged glasses, and his dentures didn't fit quite right. He had a little bit of a whistle, and the guy says, I'm Jimmy Kay, and I'm an addict. And, okay. And he's sitting in this meeting, which coincidentally happened to be the last meeting of that program that guy ever chaired or attended, right? And he just happened to be chairing that night, right? And all next to him are all these really bad-looking guys with tattoos. They're all men, and they have these really ornate things on the inside of their arm, right? And there's like peacocks and ladies with a lot of involved hair and all this, you know. And I'm just kind of fascinated, like, what planet am I on now kind of thing. And I'm making jokes about it, but I really wasn't vested particularly in being the same as everyone else, because the truth of the matter is I was 21 years old with functional eyes, ears, mouth, legs, hands, fingers, everything, and wanted to commit suicide. That's all I cared about. I'd had a few attempts before, and I just decided I was done. I was finished. I didn't care. I wasn't going to feel one more minute. I had used, and my feelings were now poking through the using, and that was intolerable for me. And so, okay, so I'm sitting here in this room. I don't care. It's just a matter before I figure it out if I'm putting the gun in my mouth or the gun in my head. Mouth, head. Wonder what. You know, it took me to have 7 years before I figured out, oh, two guns. Does that bother you that I just said that? Yeah, that's why I said it. And I said it because that if you can relate, you need outside help. Good. So this was where I was at when I was 21 years old. And I can't tell you, I got to tell you honestly, I had no desire to be clean. They say the only desire for membership is, you know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. I didn't come here with a desire to stop using. I asked a question the first night, how do I make the drugs work again? And everybody laughed. They thought that was the funniest thing they'd ever heard, you know, but I was dead stone serious. You know, I wanted to know how to make it work again because I couldn't stay here one moment longer. And, you know, This was a time in the program where people regularly got clean, couldn't stand their feelings, and blew themselves away, because it used to be like that many years ago. Thank God things have grown to a point to where now we are dealing with many parts of our illnesses, and there's a lot more people staying here with us, thank God. Yeah. I have no idea how I got my first 7 days. I remember not even knowing why I had the first 7 days, and I tried to do some of the stuff I did using during the first 7 days, like going to the nude beach. Except when I was at the nude beach straight, I noticed some really bad sexual abuse happen behind some rocks, and it freaked me out, and I couldn't go back there. And the theme of this convention is about the wide road of recovery, and I guess my friends have been telling me it means all the opportunities offered to you. But what happened for me was when I got clean, my road went teeny for a little while. I had trouble talking to members of the opposite sex because of some trauma that had happened to me. All of a sudden, those feelings came up. Not at first. I was a total hoe, like my first 30 days. But when I had about 90 days, all of a sudden it started hitting me. And I found myself not really able to speak to certain people. I was raised prejudiced against Germans really badly. I was not allowed to own a German toy. If anything said made in Germany on it, my mom broke it. I was not allowed to ride in German automobiles. It was as racist as, I guess, a black person experiences in the South. That's how I was raised towards Germans. So I'm sitting in this meeting, right? Nobody said shit to me. I have no idea what I'm doing in there, and I'm starting to get sick. It's like day two or something. And I was too scared to check in anywhere, and I didn't know you could check in somewhere and get help. And I remember this face swimming in front of me, just woo, because I was really sick, and it was this very severe-looking woman with very short hair. And she looks in my face, and she says, "Welcome to the program! My name is Ursula! I will be your sponsor, yeah?" And she wasn't kidding. God, in his infinite wisdom, sent a German woman to help me. You know, my friend and I, we were joking just now when you guys were all chanting and stuff. And she's black, and it's like, I'm looking at her, I'm going, you know, isn't it scary when Caucasian Gentile people start chanting and shit? I hope they don't have an arm signal that goes... I'm making jokes about it now, but it was quite an adjustment for me. I didn't get to NA till I had 4 months clean. I did not want to come to NA. And this guy kept telling me, his name was Jose, he said, "Karen, come to NA. You belong. You are one of us." And I would say, "Oh, come on, Jose. No, I don't want to." "Yeah, come on. You belong. You're missing it." And that's what messed with me. I don't want to miss it, you know. So I started going to NA meetings. I had just a few months, and I'm hearing everything that's resonating with me, and I'm getting really excited now. Now I got a charge. Now I'm relating. Now I know my mom had all these kids that she didn't tell me about, and here we were in the same room, right? And the dope fiends are getting up there, and they're talking about prison, and I'm relating because I got locked in places too. It just happened as a child. You know, I know what it's like to have your freedom taken away. I know what it's like to have it beaten out of you. I know what it's like to be violated because they're telling my story, even though it happened to them when they were older, right? And they're telling all this stuff, and I felt like I was at a revival meeting. I go running up to the podium, and I'm telling them, "Yeah, when I was 13, I beat the shit out of my mother and broke her collarbone. Yeah!" And it was dead quiet. It was like this. And this guy in front, he shakes his head and he said, "Damn, I didn't ever do nothing to my mama." And once again, I was different. You know, once again, I was wrong. Once again, I'd been a mistake. But you know, this one day, I was sitting in this little teeny meeting at the Survivors Club in North Hollywood around 1977, and we're sitting in this group, and the chairs are like vinyl, and they're cracked, and it's summer, and the cracks are sticking to the cheeks of our butt. And I'm feeling like I don't fit in, and I'm just sitting there listening to them talk about ducats and bonnaroos and all this crap I don't understand from, you know. And this guy comes in, and he's very effeminate, and he's flailing his arms, and he says, and he's crying, and he says, "Oh, God, help me. I'm strung out on poppers, and I can't stop, and I'm scared. I'm afraid I'll have a heart attack." And the guy chairing the meeting turns to him and says, F you! You freaking... He said, get out of here! This isn't for you! This is Narcotics Anonymous! And I'll never forget the bewildered look on this guy's face as he walked out of that meeting, because he thought he had found something where he would be embraced. And I remember sitting at that chair with my knuckles turning white, feeling like I was next. Somebody's going to turn to me and see that I didn't have tracks on my arm, and they were going to tell me that I couldn't be here either, you know? And I'm ashamed to this day that I didn't run out after that guy and make him welcome. And I decided at that moment when I was... Yay, shame. And I decided that moment that I was never going to give up my chair. No matter what anybody said or what anybody did, it was my damn chair. And if you don't like me and you don't like who I am and you feel it necessary to invalidate me, then you apparently have a problem and you need to go write about it. I used to hear, I wish I could take you back to sitting there in the Survivors Club and listening to Jimmy's truck come rolling up, the comforting feeling that it was. I guess there might be people in here who had met him before, when you're just sitting there and you hear the rumbling of his truck. He would have died laughing, or no, he would have been upset going to some of the conventions with the furs and the jewelry. He would have loved you guys. He was a simple man. He was very simple. His house was so poor, it was right by the landing strip at the Van Nuys Airport. And you'd sit there and be talking to him, and he never shut up because he knew we had nothing to say. And he just talked and talked. And we're all like, God, I wish he'd shut up so I can tell him all these important things I'm feeling. And he just kept blowing off all that incredible NA stuff. And the planes used to land right over his house, and he wouldn't shut up for, you know how normal people stop talking when a plane's landing on the house? You know, but he would just, and so you'd miss all the really good parts, right? But it was an amazing time to get clean with him rolling up, and sometimes he'd come on a Saturday morning, he'd go out in the Mojave Desert really early when it was still dark with Greg Pierce, who's gone also, who was the fat addict in the literature. And they would come in with a big orange crate full of geodes, those rocks with the crystals on the inside. And they would be closed. And they would come in, they'd plunk this thing on the table. We'd go, okay, now what's up? And he would say, these aren't geodes. They're a mystery of life. Here comes an analogy, so put on your analogy hat. He would say, they're rough and crude on the outside, but on the inside there's a miracle network of crystals and beauty, and they're functional and gorgeous, and nobody knows what's on the inside. None of us know what's on the inside. And he was so respectful, he would never throw down his religious beliefs on anybody, because he was so conscious of being a role model, he wouldn't affiliate himself with any outside group. So he would just leave these sort of analogies and clues, and he would say, so here, we all should have a geode, and now if you ever want to use, don't be tempted to look at the beauty inside. Wait until you want to get loaded, and then you can open it, but not till then. And we took these things really seriously, because just about anything he said we thought must be true, right? So we're holding these big ugly rocks going, okay, when I want to get high, I open the rock. Right? And then he leaves, right? And we figure out that if we want to open the rock, we have to go to his house because he's the only one with his stone cutter. Oiled again. So I still keep a geode on my mantelpiece. They're important to me, and if you ever see one, you know, hang on to it, because I've heard people talk about what old-timey NA was, and I don't know what their old-timey NA was, but my old-timey NA was very, very simple. It wasn't materialistic. It wasn't about show, and it wasn't about eBay, you know? It was about giving it away. You don't hoard nothing. You give it away. I have no idea where any of my books are. I give stuff away so fast I turn around and don't have what I need. Not because, like, ooh, I'm so generous. It's because I'm so furious at the commodity people have placed on these things. You know, it's so much more important to give somebody a book. I don't care if it's red or black or blue. It's so much important to hand someone something who doesn't have it than it does to hoard it for any other reason. The only thing I hang on to are my medallions, some of them, and sometimes I have to replace them, because in the old days, you guys, when somebody passed away, we left our They were called chips back then. We left our chips in the coffin or on the memorial stand, or, you know, we tossed them in the ocean. That's how we did it back then. You didn't hang on to nothing back then. And there were not recovery houses. There were sofas. It was very dangerous, actually, and we had no business doing what we did, but we were grasping and we were mistaken, and we made a lot of mistakes. I mean, we alienated our old-timers, which is one of the worst things you can do, but we wanted to be right. We wanted to say, whoa, we're the new guard. We have the perfect language, and we have the perfect meetings, we have the perfect literature, and if you don't do it the new way, we're going to invalidate all those days you stayed clean. Yeah, well, what happens when it hits the fan and there's nobody with more time than you? Oops, gee, maybe I'll have to go to somebody who's not as right as me. Personally, I've seen a tremendous amount of healing happen in Narcotics Anonymous, and to hiss when somebody speaks is just so disgusting. We have so many role models in other cultures like Native Americans who honor their elders, and I'm really glad we've come to a place where we talk about, you know, some honor for the predecessors that are in this room. Because you know what? I don't care if you use like one droplet of NyQuil in your whole using. The fact is that you've gone X amount of years without taking anything. And that, my friends, is extraordinary for a non-addict. And, you know, and my heart goes out to you. So anyway, some of the things that I've done to stay clean. I don't believe that staying clean is about going to meetings or working steps. I think staying clean is about going to meetings and working steps and reading the literature and sponsoring people and being of service. And it's way more than just a couple of stuff. It's the whole package. And I have to regularly check myself to see. When people say to me, people say, oh, it's so wonderful that you still come to meetings. How generous of you. I'm like, ha ha! Oh, I must be here for you. No, I'm here because if I don't come to meetings, I act like an asshole. My behavior is terrible. I am rude and cranky. I have to go a lot of these just to be a nice person at work, not to get fired. I have to go to loads of meetings, and I have to write stuff, and I have to have a sponsor. I have a sponsor. She has more time than me. I call her regularly. I have a writing assignment right now. Dude, I used to give those out just to get rid of sponsees I didn't like. You want to get rid of a sponsee? Here, write this. You're just too harsh, and I really need somebody more loving. Well, your ass is too lazy, and I need someone more, I don't know, sincere. Sorry. So some of the things that got to happen for me when I got clean was I got to grow up somewhat. I'm acting silly here, but I'm actually a very responsible person. I'm a financial adult. I take really good care of myself financially. No, I'm not wealthy. I'm mature, and I'm an adult, and I'm responsible, and I don't screw people over, and I don't consider what you can lend me part of my income. And I do my best when I'm in debt to get out of debt. And I'm trying to be mature in that area. I don't go screwing around on people, and I don't go breaking up relationships or marriages. And now that you've clapped for that, I have a challenge for you. You may not do it right now, but I dare you, if you're serious about this program, to find the one person who's done the worst thing to you at this convention. Walk up to that person, put your arms around them, and tell them it's over. How big is your God? You know, is your God too little to fix it? Mine isn't. My God has gotten me through some pretty heavy stuff. You know, my God has gotten me through some wonderful stuff. Some of the stuff God's got me through is when I had 8 years, I gave birth to a critically ill child. And she was on life support monitoring for a couple of years. And she had a habit of arresting in my arms. And she almost died quite a number of times, and I was furious. I don't know if anyone here has a sick kid or had something very unfortunate happen to you in recovery, and you feel like, God, that's not fair. After all the crap I went through when I was little. And now here I am in the program, and I used to go to this meeting at Coldwater Canyon. There'd be this woman who used, right? And she used when she had her kids. And she had twins, and they were healthy. and they had these little jingle bells on their shoes. And they used to run across the meeting, you know? And I'd be sitting there with my critically ill child attached to all this machinery beeping away, and she couldn't move her arms and she couldn't move her legs, and she would lie there beep, 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 you know? And I'd be so pissed off, and they'd be sharing like, hey, I really wanted to use today. I got a flat tire. And I was on the freeway, and I just really wanted to use, but like, I look at Karen and her baby. And then I figure, oh, I guess I can stay clean. I'm like, thank you. I'm glad I'm such a role model. I hate you. May you fall in a trash compactor, you know? So the day came when I was able to affix this. She was 15 months old. I was able to affix this kid's hands to a railing on the stroller, and she could support her weight with her legs. And I thought, I'm going to do that in the meeting. Maybe my kid can't walk. Maybe her arms don't work and she can't talk, but I'm going to just put her up here and let her be kind of upright and hope she doesn't fall over, you know? So I went to this meeting, I propped her up, and somebody was sharing. I had detached her wires and stuff, and my kid ran across the room. Ran across the room. And the meeting stopped, and people started clapping, you know? And what I learned that day is that I cannot decide what God is capable of. And sometimes you got to let go for God to do his thing. And no, she didn't get well whiz bang. I mean, she was in and out of children's hospitals for years, and she was in terrible pain. I remember she had a really big surgery when she was 9 years old, and I remember her pressing that button for the morphine, and it's the only answer I had for her as a mom. She was just groaning, telling me, it hurts, Mommy, it hurts. And this little voice that I remember having myself when I was getting abused, that little voice I used to say, it hurts, and I heard my voice come out of her, it hurts, and all I can say is press the button, baby, just press that button, press the button, you know. And I walked out into the hallway, and there was a little girl, she was black, and she was in there with sickle cell anemia. And they put a little nurse's cap on her and gave her a clipboard because she had gone through that round of treatment. She's ready to be picked up, but they couldn't find her mom because she was an addict on the street. So they gave her a little job. And so you see, this place was really dark. And I had walked by the cancer ward early, and there was a teenage girl, and she was bald. And she was standing there in the open doorway. And as I walked by her, our eyes met, and I was sort of struck by her baldness. And she looked at me, and she put her hands on her hips and stuck her foot out and looked at me like, take a picture to last longer, kind of thing. I walked into this hallway where they let you go be by yourself, and there's a bench with this glass thing at Lucille Packer Children's Hospital, and I remember putting the cool of the glass against my forehead and touching my palms on it. I looked down at the courtyard, and just for that moment I thought, you know, Karen, it hurt a whole lot when you were using, and it hurts a whole lot clean. What you could do is you could push yourself through the glass and smash yourself down, and you wouldn't have to feel anymore. And as I was saying this, I looked across the courtyard to the roof of the adult unit, and there was the bald teenager. And she was standing there. It was twilight, and she had a guy's jacket on her shoulders. And I looked at her, and we made eye contact, and I thought, shit, this girl's going to jump right now. Am I going to tell somebody? And as she stood there, this really fine-looking man walked up to her without a coat. And he put his arms around her, and he took his hand. And you know when a man is gentle? And he smoothed her bald head, and they started to make out. And I'm looking at this just like, paradigm shift! And I'm thinking, okay, what's really happening is she doesn't know how many moments she has left, so she's grabbing one. And so I walked away from the window just in case. Because I might have one of those coming. I was married in this program to a guy I met when I had 11 months. We went out on a Saturday night. He went home for clothes on Wednesday. Isn't that how it works? And he stayed for 26 years. And we were married, and we had two children, and I used to have this great pitch about, you see that relationships can last forever. And what I've come to find is that relationships last as long as people permit them to. I don't blame God for the end of a marriage and the torture for children when their family splits up. I believe in the failings of human beings who do the best they can, and sometimes best sucks. And when he left, I want to tell you that my biggest fears in NA have all been realized. I've been terribly afraid of being clean during major surgery, getting through that, and coming out not being strung out. And that's happened for me. I have an artificial hip and a few giblets missing. And I thought I couldn't stay clean through the death of a parent, and I was able to be an asset instead of a liability when that happened. I was able to kiss my father's hands and thank him, even though we didn't have a relationship, thank him for writing that check every month before he died. I was terribly afraid of divorce clean. I have a terrible time with abandonment. And what I thought was true, I equated my relationship with my recovery, and I thought if one left, the other would go. And what I've found is that if you stay clean through the most horrible thing that could happen, even 26 years with the same human being, if you can stay clean through betrayal, you will find a peace that surpasses all human understanding. But the pain, I'm not going to lie to you, is horrific. It's agony. I remember tossing and turning night after night. I remember one more time wanting to end it all. I remember not thinking I could put one foot in front of each other, and I lived with two very angry teenagers who blamed me, you know? And how do you keep parenting, and how do you not be abusive when somebody's blaming you for what's going on and you're left, and at night your heart aches and you feel this bed and the bed's empty and you're just so used to the smell and the touch of this person. All of my five senses felt completely destroyed because I didn't have, you know, anything. I went and got this dog, you guys. I went to the SPCA. There's a reason why people give away dogs, okay? And they didn't even give this one away. They found it in the street. So somebody just went boom with this guy, and this dog is freaking insane. We are identical. It's this half pug, half Jack Russell Terrier, right? The worst of both, right? And I got it because it was called Funny Face. It's Funny Face because it's schizophrenic. And this thing alternately cuddles with me inside my bed or bites my face. It has not declared a position yet. But it's been 4 years, and I don't know where I'd be without it, because I'm so used to abusive relationships, I guess. So these are some of the bad things, and some of the incredible things that have happened to me in my life as I was able to pursue my dreams in recovery. I got to tell you right now, if you have a talent or a gift, and you've decided it's something you can't do because, you know, you can't stay clean if you do it, that's bullshit. Sometimes you're expected to go out and foray into this area of your talent or interest because you're supposed to bring recovery there. So when I had 2 years, I decided I wanted to be a clean comedian, and they didn't have them back then, you know. It was unheard of. And so I started going to nightclubs and stuff and getting up and doing my act and leaving clean. And then people in the program got wind of it and said, oh, you can't do that. Oh, no. You will get loaded for sure. And fine, okay. I tried working in recovery. I destroyed a number of lives. It obviously is not my calling. I owe big amends to everyone I counseled. I sucked. So what I did is I waited tables, I did menial jobs, I was a maid for a couple years, and at night I worked in comedy clubs, and when I got good, all the people that gave me crap for doing it in the program started asking for tickets. I started working at clubs all around the country and going to meetings all around the country, and people would say, wow, that's the hardest thing to do, isn't it? No, you act stupid for 45 minutes. That's the job. And go to meetings everywhere. My dreams were coming true. You know, I had the guy at the house. I started having children, even though some were sick. And what happened after that was I did that until I couldn't do it anymore. My daughter's illness kind of kicked the funny out of me once she was declared well. And I need to tell you that after that big surgery, that hospital stay when she was 9, she started getting so much better. First of all, remember I told you her arms and legs didn't work very well. But she became a very accomplished tap dancer. And she was also tested for deafness back then. But she's a sound engineer today. And her hands function so well now that if I need like a little clasp closed on my necklace, she's so much more adept at that thing that she has to do all the little delicate things. That's how healed she is, right? But it's like when she, yeah, I guess. But when she got to that state, right, all of a sudden there was space for me to have my feelings. I wanted another child, right? So I got pregnant, and I was told that I was going to have problems with this one too. And I was terrified, and people in the program said, that's okay, we'll bring meetings to you. So I'm lying there up in this bed. I can't get out of bed, and there's like bikers in my bedroom. There's like 20 bikers sitting in my bedroom, like reading the material. And I'm like in my little nightie all pregnant and stuff. That's who came for me, and that's who are my friends today. And so I gave birth October 17th, 1989, which is not significant to anyone unless you're from the Bay Area, because right after I gave birth, and I had one of my biker friends sitting there looking at me, the earthquake hit, 7.1, and I was on a table with wheels. Skateboarding is not a crime. The hospital was Dominican Hospital. It was pretty well trashed in the earthquake. Not one baby was harmed. But what happened was there was no power. There was no ability for me to wash myself for 72 hours. We were trapped in this hospital. A couple people in the program died downtown. And when I was finally released home, it was discovered this kid had some medical problems also, and I was told I had to bring her back. I lost my mind with grief. And through a series of coincidences, they found a way to bring equipment to me so I would not have to take my kid away from myself again, and then the power went out. The city lost all power. And there's nothing as beautiful as being in a powerless situation and hearing the roar of the motorcycles in the background as your brothers are bringing you a generator so that the baby doesn't have to go back to the hospital. And the big bad outlaws brought me a generator. And I got to stay with my kid. And because of some of this trauma, my emotions got a little bit too intense and I had trouble being funny. And I actually probably had a little bit of a breakdown in recovery. And I went back to being a maid. And I had been on national TV a whole bunch. I had my own radio show. I was big, right? I was scrubbing toilets and cleaning noodles out of trash cans and staying clean no matter what. Until somebody walked by me and said, you're funny, you should work with kids. And I'm always thinking everything's from God, right? So I started attending classes for a teaching credential. Now, I hadn't even been accepted to this college, but the semester had started, and I notified them I'd be attending their classes, and they should probably find me funding, because I intended to go. And I was sitting in these classes doing all the homework, and I hadn't been accepted. And it's really funny, when you do that, they find money. And boy, did I pay for it for years, you know, really lousy loan. But I got the teaching credential, and I started working in public schools, shaping young minds. And then I went and I got some more college, and I got a master's degree, and I started teaching college, and then I didn't like it because it wasn't dramatic enough. And so I went back, and I've been at the same school now for 8 years. And I'm completely out as a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I usually wear my numbers with my clean date on it. They celebrate with me. They come to me when they have issues that have to do with recovery or whatever. I've told my story just as a matter of course, but really I'm just expected to be a public school employee. And I do that, and I'm vested, and I have retirement, and I'm an adult. And every once in a while I'll go out and do recovery comedy. But pretty much, you know, I have so much peace in my life, and I'll close with this. As I was trying to explain to my friend what it's like to have 32 years, 6 months, and 3 days, is I don't know if you've ever experienced going to an art museum and looking at a painting, or looking at the ocean, or looking at a plant or something, and just for that moment you feel this feeling of awe, just about, oh my God, this is so amazing, this moment. Maybe you've only felt it on acid, I don't know. But what it feels like for me right now is that at any moment, at any time, if I can just hold still, that feeling comes back to me of gratitude an appreciation because I didn't die when I was driving under the influence, even though I woke up driving a number of times. Because that woman who had done these things to me now lives across the street from me and is dying of terminal cancer. I walked through the prison camps with my mother. We walked through with our arms around each other, and I listened to her story of what she saw and the things that happened to her and her body and what she witnessed and what happened to my family. And we held each other. And we went into one of the barracks, and we closed the door, and we pissed. We stopped blaming each other and we pissed on the ground of the original abuse, and it was awesome. And we are the best of friends today. She cries in my arms and she asks if I can ever forgive her for the things she's done to me, and it hurts me when she brings it up because it's so over, because it's so healed. If you can imagine the parent or the being who abused you the most and loving them more than any other breathing, living human being, that's my relationship with my abuser today. It's healed. It's gorgeous. This last summer, her cancer was really gnarly, and she had a hole in her abdomen, and I was required to pack it. A lot of real hands-on care with her, and every single moment, every packing, every crying, every administration of whatever I had to do with her, for her, with that body, washing that body, the hands, the arms, the legs, was so precious. I realize that I am so blessed to have this incredible circle come back around to where I can be a service of someone who didn't know how to be a service to me and now learns. I was never told I love you as a child. She tells me I love you every day. She told me on the phone that when I got up and talked to you today to make sure I tell all of you that she loves all of you, and she's so glad that you're here and glad that you're clean. And I am so proud of you. Omaha, Nebraska, I'm so damn proud my dad is from here. And thank you for being a wonderful convention. Thank you.